Brownstone Media Group is proud to bring you the best in entertainment and interviews each and every month. Listen to our podcast, View from the Stoop, on iTunes or SoundCloud. Check out our engaging and informative website at viewfromthestoop.com and join the conversation with our family on social media via Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We're always striving to show the culture in a positive light. Welcome to the family.
Welcome back, family. It's been a busy year at the Brownstone. We've been growing, and we're going to make moves to bring you guys the best information and entertainment we can possibly present. But the downside is that sometimes it takes a little while to introduce people who are special to us. This week's guest has been patiently waiting on us, and the wait is over. Nelson Jackson III is an amazing songwriter, producer, and musical director who's been in and out of the film and music industries for the better part of the last two decades. Definitely want to listen to his amazing story of faith and perseverance. As a minister and a part of the entertainment business, he shared with us how he has maneuvered through the pitfalls of success, and we're proud to bring that story to you. Take a listen, let us know what you think. The big things are around the corner, family, and this is part of the beginning. So let's go. Okay, for everyone who seems to have somehow avoided your talent or not seen any of your work, please introduce yourself. Tell everybody who you are, what you do, and how you got to where you are.
My name is Nelson Jackson III. I am a musician, been playing the piano and organ since I was I started at the age of 7. And then I grew playing up in my dad's church, who was a pastor. Playing like 5 to 7 times a week. And then about the age of 15 is when I started producing. I had an uncle who actually was he was signed to Motown in the 70s. So he, you know, one of the old guys who never really let go of the dream. Mm-hmm. So he bought some equipment. His son kind of called me one day. He was like, you know, we're out here making beats and everything. You know, you play, so why don't you come over here and help? And, you know, from that point, I started producing. So by the time I was about 19 years old, not only was I playing for various artists, but I also landed a publishing deal with Sony, ATV Music at the age of 19. And so spent time writing, producing, and just traveling with different artists. And then about 4 years ago was when God opened the door for me to get into the film, the television and film industry. And It was just a blessing how everything happened. And so, you know, I did my first project with a production team, and then from that point on, I've been working with one of the producers of that project ever since. So, you know, then that's where we are now. And then at the same time, I'm also in ministry. Right now my life is pretty much music and actually pastoring at the same time right now.
Okay, so you seem to have two different callings, and I want to get into that because it's always fascinating to know or find out when people realize that they had not only just a talent, but a calling to go out and share that talent with the world. So which came first, the desire to ministry or the desire to share your music?
That's a fun question. The music, that, you know, of course, that, hands down, for any and everybody, that's cool. That's what everybody likes. When people know you do music, oh, wow, that's attractive. That's great. You get a lot of popularity. But where I come from, the ministry portion, that's not cool. It's not popularity. So that part I never wanted. Ministry, I looked at my dad's life, and when I saw him go through, I saw what we went through as the children and the wife of a pastor, and I was like, no thanks. But actually, you know, I spoke about it this Sunday at church. When God has a purpose for you, that's what you're technically wrapped in. That's what you're covered in. And it's just like it's like with Apple. The purpose of the iPhone is to be an iPhone, not the Android. So if an iPhone tries to be an Android, it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. And so I learned the hard way because God created me to be a specific thing. I have to learn that if I try to do it, it's funny, and I feel like there's people who, like the book of certain books, like the book of Jonah, just what was the purpose of that being in the Bible? It didn't make sense to me what he went through until I saw where I am now. That's who I was. And when I realized that when you run from what God has called you to do, you will live a Jonah-type life. And a lot of things in my life started to go that way. I'm talking about, even after I got, like, God revealed so many things, get the door open to be, you know, a Stony writer, having the opportunity to connect with people from different labels. I have countless stories, you know, being in the home of the infamous and famous Jimmy Iovine, you know, and him hearing my music and him loving my music in his own home and seeing the door still closed. And it was just like God saying, like, you know, I can get you in these places, but this is not where you're supposed to be. And it was almost like a drastic way of him showing me that's not where you're designed. And the moment I accept what the call was, that's when all kind of other doors started to open up. The TV and film opened up when I accepted the call, you know. And it's amazing to see, you know, at the end of the day, yes, my music was my gift and I loved it, but what I had to learn was that God gave me that gift in order to put me in the areas that I needed to get in, because I wouldn't have gotten to those areas and gotten close to those people, which helped me to get where I am now in ministry. I wouldn't have got that without the music. So that was your gift, but the ministry was your definite call.
From the moment you felt the call, and I know you said you were signed to Sony, how does one go from the idea to the execution? Like, how do you go from knowing this is what you want to do and feeling led that direction to actually, you know, becoming a songwriter?
Wow. That is interesting. That just came so natural. I didn't even really realize it. Like, let me even go back to even how I started playing piano. This is the thing too, you know, I it's hard for me not to connect the two because I see it a certain way now. Mm-hmm. But like I said, when God ordains us to be who we're going to be, even before we're here, we're already spiritual and we're wrapped in flesh. And so the gifts were already there. They're irrevocable. He already gave it to me. So what happened, what I learned, in the hindsight, you know, as I was growing up in my dad's church, the gift of music was already in me. And so what happened, whenever that gift heard something that it could relate to, well, you know, back in the day, we had pews. There was no chairs. It was a pew. And so what I would do whenever the piano player would play at 2 years old, I would turn around and start playing the back. The only kid doing this in the church, I start playing the back of the benches because that just was in me. So it wasn't even something I even looked to do or tried to do. I just turned around and started playing, and eventually, it took my mom and them about 2 years. Why, you really want to play? Yeah, I think I do. It just happened, you know what I'm saying? So I ended up going to school for a second. After a year, I surpassed the whole class. And then I ended up starting to play for my dad's church at about 7 years old. And then even from that point, I was already writing poetry, called myself writing raps and things like that. Next thing you know, I get into songwriting, already a lyricist. And so after so long, like, so by the time I got to the age of 18, now this whole talent has just come to life to me, writing songs and producing, you know, God giving me access to a studio via my uncle who, you know, bought so much stuff. So it just literally got a lot of everything to come together. And it wasn't even something I really tried. It just all came out naturally. It was amazing. Just to think back and look at it, just how everything happened.
So what would you consider your first big break?
I would say when me and my cousin signed our publishing deal with Sony.
Okay.
That was when everything just came alive to a whole nother level. You know, being faithful to the call of being a musician, we ended up meeting a famous singer who everybody knows, you know, when his hit For You, biggest song, King Lattimore, who's like a brother now still. I met him through my cousin who had the video equipment, and he thought, you know, he saw us and was like, wow, you guys are talented, introduced us to his manager. And his manager was already working, so everything worked. His manager was already working on a deal with Sony to sign 10 producers, and we happened to become two of those 10 producers.
Okay. Can you explain to people, because I think a lot of times we know what a recording contract is, and we know that, you know, a producer does this, but a publishing deal, some people out there probably don't truly understand it. So can you explain that to them?
Well, a publishing deal, how can I really sum this up? I get into this all the time with people. It's basically because a writer and a producer can sign a publishing deal, which is you know, whenever there's a song that's written, it's you know, you have different levels of different types of payments. But when signing the publishing deal, that has to do with the pretty much your song being published and taking a life of its own. And so, say if I, you know, whenever I get a song, you know, placed on a record, the publishing aspect really has nothing. One part of it does, but really has nothing to do with it being on the album and the album being sold. The publishing deal deals with the life of your song that lasts even far beyond the records being sold, which means that's radio play, that's airplane play, that's store play, that's different play, you know, now internet radio or Spotify, you're playing in movies and things like that. So it's getting your song in these different avenues to get what they call a mechanical royalty, where, you know, as many times as your song plays, you're getting a check. So your song can outlive even you. You know, outlive your album ever selling as long as it plays. It doesn't never have to sell again in the stores, or and you never have to be downloaded. It literally just has to be played. And that's the biggest way you make money in music. Is just, you know, that's why everybody wants to hit, because hits never stop playing. Like, I know the individual that wrote, what's the song? Oh my gosh. From Luther Vandross. Here and Now.
Yeah, I was about to say Here and Now.
Here and Now. He's actually a member of the church I used to play at West Angeles, and this man is still living an amazing life because of the mechanical royalties. The mechanical royalties is a whole other thing. Off the performance royalties, which has to do with the plays and things like that. Just a year, from as many times that song's been played in different countries on different radio stations, how many times, he's still living extremely well off one song.
So it sounds to me like if I was a young person about to try and start off, I would want to be a songwriter more than I'd want to be a performer.
Oh, very much so. I mean, yeah, if you're not writing, you know, then at the end of the day, you're pretty much your career is controlled by the labels, by the producers. You know, of course, you may get points on the album, but everybody knows and everybody's excited. You sign the contract, you get this advance. Well, that advance, the cost of that record, they're not giving you that money. It's your record, so you got to pay for it. And so if you ended up coming out the pocket $1 million and see you pay that $1 million back, you don't make any money. And then once it's done, then depending on how many points you have on that record, and again, when the record sells, so if the record doesn't really sell that much, or when it stops selling, you stop making money. If you're not writing, yeah, you're, and again, yeah, writing or producing and part of that writing team, then yeah, you're, it won't be that great for you, basically.
Is this something that you had to teach yourself? Was it something you were aware of before you kind of got into the game? Or this was learned stuff the hard way?
The hard way.
Mm-hmm.
This is me talking about something that I went through and had literally. I remember even with my publishing deal, I talked about it, and it was like it was a great moment, a pivotal moment in my life. But at the same time, it was one of the worst moments because of me not knowing some things and me not really, you know, we had a lawyer, but he wasn't that experienced in entertainment. He was just a close friend. And we ended up, you know, and again, I know this after the fact. It wasn't the guy who we signed, so it wasn't his responsibility to make sure everything in that contract was right. It was ours.
Okay.
So, you know, I had to learn the hard way. If you don't speak up, then there's a very great chance. And a lot of that things that even happened during, as a matter of fact, a couple of times during and before the publishing deal, when I did certain things on certain people's records that I would remain, you know, keep them nameless. But because me not doing things correctly, thinking that they're just going to come to me, make sure it's right, I received nothing. And, you know, I had people like my uncle's really close with somebody in the industry. He got me on a record that sold over at that time. Sold about 13, 14 million copies. And so one song, and it was a single, that one song could have made me so much money. And when I talked to him, he's like, well, you didn't speak up. That was your responsibility.
Mm.
You know, so all this stuff. So I had to go in and learn, you know, Sleepless Nights is upset. Like, why did you not? So I got to the point where I started reading books and started taking advantage of my relationships and asking questions. And so it's pretty hard to get over on me now, you know, and that's why, because I went through it the hard way.
It's like when you were little and they told you to stop touching the stove, and then finally they just let you touch it, and you never did that again.
And I did it. Yeah, and I was that guy. See, I was the iron stove. I was that guy. Yeah.
So during all this time, when did you start to feel the call to ministry?
That was another thing that was natural but ignored.
Okay.
I was always funny. You know, I grew up in the Koji church. My dad was a pastor, so no matter what, I had to go to everything. I played baseball. I had to go to church on the baseball night. I was almost a baseball game, you know. But, you know, we'll be doing Bible drills. I'm always winning. Or, you know, we're in the different classes, and I'm always the one articulating things a certain way, not on purpose, not that I even cared. It just made sense to me. Of course, you had your youth nights, and then they want somebody, one of the young persons to speak. I'm asked to speak, and it just came natural. I spoke and, you know, never thought anything of it, you know. And then over the course of time, I just realized, you know, a couple of preachers came to me as I was, again, that I'm playing at other churches, and then let's forget, we had a youth revival, and I invited some of the buddies that I met over the course of me playing. And when I never forget, I'm 19, that's when I my first time speaking as an adult, and the guy, he was about 28, just started pastoring. And he was like, man, like, God has a call in your life. Like, the way you just articulated that, like, first of all, and there's no internet. And he's like, where did you get that from? And that's what I saw in scripture. He was like, bro, like, that was absolutely amazing. And so from that point, I knew something was there. But, I didn't want it because of what I saw my dad going through. I also didn't want it because I knew I still, not that you have to be perfect, but I knew I had some things I needed to work out. And I saw a lot of my friends who were going into ministry at a young age. I saw them doing some things that I felt was not appropriate for people who call themselves leaders in the church. Not that we're supposed to be perfect, but James 3 tells us that if we get in that office, it's an honorable office, but when we get in the office of being a teacher, our judgment will be greater than the one that's being taught. Mm-hmm. And so I take that stuff seriously. So, you know, it took me more than 10 years to finally accept it. And that was after God started closing doors. But I never, and to this day, I'd be totally transparent. I still don't want it. Mm-hmm.
Was it hard to kind of make a transition where, well, you know, let me back up. Secular music and gospel music and R&B music, they kind of, people have come from the church and blended what's done in the church into secular and R&B music and rap music. Going the other direction, if you will, was it hard to let some of that go, some of the maybe the content, and move in the direction that you were being led?
Not really. Like, one thing that's so interesting about my experience is I did try to do certain things that would have probably come back to make me seem a little controversial or a little suspect. Mm-hmm. But all the doors that God actually allowed to open, they're nothing. If you go and look at my name or some songs that I've done, I've written or I've been a part of records, I've been a part of, there's nothing that somebody could ever go and question who I am and why I am now. Like, God, I never allowed those doors to open. Like, I got to them, but never got through them. And the only doors that I did and made great money off of were songs that to this day that I can, you know, if I have grandkids, I can still let them hear. And it's not going to make me feel embarrassed. Like, that's who I used to be. No, I can still say that's who I am now. Mm-hmm. So I think I know God had a plan from the beginning, and that's the door. Those are the doors he desired to open.
I've asked this of other Christian artists, gospel artists. Growing up in the church, we all had that moment where hip hop had come along, rap music, and we were all in like elementary school, junior high. And then gospel rap or Christian rap came along. And we're not going to talk about how some of that early Christian rap was a little suspect, but I'm not going to put no names on it, but you know what I'm saying. And
yes, sir.
Your mom and your dad were not checking for the Christian rap, and then as they started to get more sophisticated, they really weren't checking for the Christian rap.
No, sir.
The more it started to sound like what you could hear on the radio, the less they were trying to have it in the house. So was there pushback on the type of music that you would ultimately end up doing? Because it's not necessarily, you know, the gospel that your grandmother used to listen to.
That's a twofold thing. Because we've had conversations about it. But as far as, which is, this is a sad part of, you know, everything happens for a reason, so I don't regret it. But a lot of what I've done musically was not really supported by my household. Even gospel, I remember one of the most heartbreaking moments for me was at the age of 24, I was able to be one of the live musicians on the album that Donnie McClurkin recorded at West Angeles in 2004. Mm-hmm. And my parents chose to go to an anniversary service of, again, no offense, of a storefront church, other than supporting something that, well, now you go to the anniversary once a year, every year. This is once in a lifetime thing, and they never came. They didn't come, and that happened kind of a lot. So, you know, as far as the music that I've done and been a part of, they wouldn't even really know. But we've had the conversation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, respectfully, I would always hold my ground because, you know, my dad, he was definitely old school, but it was old school from the sense of what I learned a lot of times. It, you know, I'm very analytical and logical, and I look within things. And one thing I noticed is sometimes it didn't seem like it had anything to do with the music more than it had to do with what he didn't like. So I felt like even if my dad wasn't a pastor, didn't know Jesus, he still wouldn't have liked it because that's not the era he came from.
Okay.
You know? So we'd have the conversations about, like, he didn't like makeup either. Like I said, he just came from a whole other world. Mm-hmm. But we've had those conversations about, you know, I'll never forget, we were watching some show. I don't know if you remember, it's going a couple of years ago. It's like a Bible show. And then each person played, and if you, whatever team won, you were playing for a charity.
Okay.
You know, and that the money didn't go to you. And so one of the contestants that was the two of the contestants, it was teams of two. Two of the contestants at one time, they were gospel rappers.
Mm.
And you can see the sincerity on there. Again, they were playing for a charity to give back to young people that were going through. And my dad went in.
Mm.
You know, that's an abomination. And, you know, that's being like the world, blah, blah. And my thing was, wow, you know, last I checked, one of the main issues that Jesus had was the fact that people judged the outer and not really looked at the content of the heart. And I'm wondering, I'm like, so you can't support somebody who this is, they're not trying to be like the world. This is, they feel like this is their talent and this is what they have to offer. They want to offer God something. They might not want to be an usher. They might want to rap. But at the same time, and, you know, I'm going to say this real generally, you know, in a general sense, but I'm definitely don't judge people. But my thing is, how are you going to talk about these people and their sincerity? But then there's certain gospel artists because they're singing who've been caught up in all kinds of scandals, and then they live a lifestyle that you as a pastor have an issue with.
Mm-hmm.
But yet you can listen to them because they're singing the way you like, because they're singing a traditional song. Now I know my dad, and I know how he felt because he's from that era. I know how he felt about certain lifestyle. But yet you're okay with that because they're singing this way. But then when you have somebody who's doing gospel rap, who might be married, who might be faithful to their wife, ain't living out there, you know, doing, there's no scandals because they're rapping, now something's wrong.
Right.
Probably. Yeah, you know, so
I remember,
that was my experience with that, but they never listened to me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I remember back in the day sitting down with, I was at my aunt's house, and you remember Tremaine Hawkins? She was fresh into the whole thing. And I remember the beat, mm-hmm. the beat was more up tempo. And I remember, what you listening to? It's Tremaine Hawkins, you know, gospel music. That's not gospel music. That's too fast
for
gospel.
Oh my God.
And that's the era we came from. I mean, I think we were the generation who started to get the change in music. And it doesn't mean that the message changed, but I think you would be able to look back at, like, in the 40s, they would have gone to the church and they would have heard a certain type of music. Well, we now mm-hmm. in the 90s. Just equipment has changed, so that changed the sound of music. You can't take away from the message, because if I drove a car from the 20s, let's say I bought a Mustang mm-hmm. in like 1960, and I went out and bought a Mustang over here, they're going to sound different.
Right.
Because technology has changed. We're still going A to B.
Right.
The car gonna sound the way it sounds.
Yeah. Right. When I tell you, we had all those conversations, and I never forget one time I used pants as an example. Matter of fact, I will say this was interesting. Like, I actually broke my dad from some of his judgmental ways never forget, out in Los Angeles, we have a station 102.3, and we were having a conversation about secular music and, you know, again, him bashing secular artists. And so I had them turn on 102.3, and the perfect song was all Boyz II Men, Down on Bended Knees. Mm-hmm. And I said, can you guys please, for my sanity and for my spirituality, can you listen to the lyrics of this song and tell me where you hear sin so that I can stop listening to it? You couldn't say nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't say nothing. And so one of the things I, even in that conversation, I was saying, it's like, yeah, and like, and, you know, no disrespect, I said, but, you know, you guys are kind of always, you know, I just, the same thing you're saying, judging music based off of where, you know, it doesn't match where you came from. I said, but I said, well, we believe, and I use Pans as an example. I said, man, in the 70s, y'all wearing bell bottoms. In the 80s, straight leg tight. 90s, we were back, we were in baggy hip hop jeans, but they never stopped being jeans.
Right.
And what happens is, you know, like, you know, I said, you got this whole era of, you know, when I said this is where you found, you say this is where you found Christ, you found God in the 70s with the bell bottoms. So because that's where you found them, then that must be where God is. And so, yeah, you got like this booming store selling bell bottoms, but because that's where you met God, you feel like the bell bottoms can't adjust or evolve. So now you're still selling bell bottoms in the 80s. Your clientele's going to go down. You still selling bell bottoms in the 90s. Your clientele's going to go down even more. You know, and just, I mean, I don't know, I just added to the whole point, but I mean, I'm saying that to say that even I had that conversation with them, and I'm seeing even now as a new pastor, my dad passed away 3 years ago, but I'm still seeing the result of that mentality because our churches are dwindling in membership because we're still trying to sell bell bottoms in 2018.
I think a lot of Christian youth who grow up in the church or in Christian schools struggle sometimes coming out and going into adulthood because of maybe, I know, like myself, I went to a Christian school pretty much my entire life. There were a few years in public school, but you struggle coming out of it because of an expectation that was put upon you to be almost perfect or live the most perfect Christian life you can. And I think a lot of us struggle with the music, with, you know, just being an adult before we hopefully understand, A, it's a forgiveness story. At the end of the day, the whole thing is a forgiveness story. And I think B, understanding that you're going to stumble. There's no man who's walking this planet who is not going to stumble. The idea is to attempt to not stumble and understand you're forgiven if you do, and don't do that again. You're going to make mistakes. Don't make that same mistake again. And if you do, you're still forgiven, but you better be trying. And I think a lot of us, whether it be the music, dressing, just living, have struggled coming out of an adolescence or a teen years spent in the church, trying to reconcile that with being an adult in a world that makes it increasingly harder to live that way.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, very, very much so.
So, I mean, the conversation about the music is, you know, one side to a coin that's going to be talked about for years. In 30, 40 years, we're going to have the same conversation. You know, they might be listening to something that we might find offensive, probably just because it's bad music. But, you know, we're going to have to understand the message is going to be, it's being delivered in another way that hopefully I'll be mature enough to say, this sounds like garbage, but at least they're saying the right things.
Exactly.
Because it's going to sound like garbage.
I totally. Oh, but it's already on its way. Oh, my God.
Man.
But yeah, I'm trying to remember me and how they were with me. So I'm trying to make sure that I don't take on that same spirit. Like, I'm so conscious of it, you know. And I'm very supportive, even with the ministry. Like, I've hired, you know, I got some guys playing at a younger, hungry. You know what I'm saying? The thing, too, I feel like a lot of times what we don't do, which I know the generation before us didn't do, is it's helped to impart in these guys. You know, I have some very amazing musicians, you know what I'm saying? But I come from a church where West Angeles has been known for its music forever. So even when I got there, I was a great musician, which got me there, but I wasn't still I wasn't as developed as I am now being a part of that ministry. Because when I tell you, every Sunday, most people don't even realize this. You know, they listen to West Angeles, especially when it was like me, Mike Burrell, and Jason White, and all the music sound a certain way. It's like, okay, well, y'all understand the rehearsals? like, we were on each other's head. Like, you would have thought we were doing a live recording every Sunday. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that people were just good at playing. It was, we were going to make sure our I's were dotted and our T's were crossed. And so I'm just trying to, you know, be that guy that does that with this young generation. Very, very talented, but just making sure, hey, never turn your ears off. Dot your I's, cross your T's. And so just trying to make sure, you know, at least from who I can text, is to make sure, hey, I'm trying to make sure that I can still, in their ear, give them a good sense of direction and make sure that they're trying to keep music sounding decent. Yeah, man, let me say it that way.
So you're now fully formed as a musician, so to speak, and you've started the ministry as well. When did you start putting the two together, sir? Or was it always together? Was it always joined?
For the most part, it was always joined, but now it's really fully functional. You know, like I'm that guy. You know, we've only been in for what? Next week will be 3 months total. You know, so I'm actually the musician still and preaching. So now, like I said, now it's like a fully functional thing. But prior to that, you know, I was just one of the head musicians at West Angeles, and I spoke here and there for different events, but now they're both together. So.
Did your career change?
Definitely tough, but.
Did your career change when you really started to commit yourself?
Let me say it. It didn't necessarily change, because God is still opening doors as far as new projects, but I've had to say no to some things because of the ministry, you know, just the other week. You know, I know this is a blessing. Some people wish they had this opportunity, so I'm grateful that I have the opportunity. But just see, literally the other week, I had to turn down a TV gig that was paying a couple thousand because it was on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. So I'm having to do that kind of stuff now because I got to be there on Sunday. I don't regret it, but that's where I have to be. So it's affected me somewhat as far as what I can do, but it didn't really affect the phone calls that are coming in, which I'm grateful for.
Okay. The songwriting, the ministry, but you're also a producer. When did you start producing?
Yes.
Is that something that was always happening as well?
You're talking about the music production?
Uh-huh.
That started at about 15, between 14 and 15, where I really started to get into production. And again, my uncle just started buying new stuff, bought a computer, so I started using. You're probably familiar with a program called Logic.
Uh-huh.
My cousin started using Logic, and then next thing you know, we got Pro Tools, and, you know, I really got into it. I ate and slept production,
mm-hmm.
And it's benefited me to this day. You know,
selling beats on MySpace?
Thankfully, I didn't have to. But yeah, I had some friends that were. But yeah, like, we really, like I said, once we really got good into everything, we ended up getting that deal with Sony. So, yeah, like, editing vocals became one of my big things. It was interesting to see how I evolved into a producer. Like, I really ain't got time to do that part, but just how it's weird. I don't even know how my brain articulates the things that I do, but I know it happened for a reason, because once I got into the film industry, literally my first five films were all different genres. The first one was like a gospel slight stage play. The second one was a romantic comedy. The third one was a suspense film, like a What Lies Beneath. The fourth one was a horror film. And I know some people are going to be busy for that. The fourth one was a horror film. And then the fifth one was it was a faith-based. And then my next one was a faith-based as well. But because of how I see music, and it's not just something that I do, like, you look back and you see around. God put the right people to tell you the right things at the right time. And so the one thing that I learned to do in the midst of me doing new projects is what I'll do is I'll saturate myself. You tell me what you're looking for, I'll saturate myself and do nothing but listen to that for at least 7 days. 7 to 14 days, I'm watching a romantic comedy, different romantic comedy movies and doing different things. And the next thing I know, once I start doing the work, it's just coming out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's kind of how I started to approach. Eventually, started approaching my production, because people start coming to you for different stuff. Can you do it? I'm not gonna tell them no. You know, I'm gonna figure it out.
Okay, let's talk about music supervision or composing. Once again, it's another area where people don't necessarily fully understand it. I think there's a general idea of, oh, he's responsible for the music. But can you explain what a music supervisor does? Like, what's the responsibilities involved? Are you composing the music? Are you just putting yourself all through the movie? Like, you finding people? What happens there?
You're responsible for all the musical components for the film, which, because today you have films with different budgets, depending on the film will determine how much you'll have to do. But being a music supervisor, you're responsible for either composing or finding the composer to write music, or finding the music, licensing the music, or finding somebody to write the music. Like, it's a big job. There's literally a major responsibility. You want to license the music, you got to find who the publishing company. You got to negotiate with them. You got to give them paperwork. You got to do contracts. You got to, it's everything. It's not just sitting down and scoring a film, which is what I did originally. Once I got a music supervision, again, it became me having to be responsible for every aspect of the film, musically. Like I said, and mainly what they don't, most people understand, if you're responsible for that paperwork to make sure the paperwork is right. Because, you know, legally things can happen that you might not want to happen that you would be held responsible for. So music supervision is a very intense job. All the way around.
What was your first music supervision role?
My first one was it was a film called The Sincere. That was a suspense film. It wasn't because if you watch this, I'm saying, like, having to be in the music supervisor, depending on what who all is active on that project will determine how much work you have to do. So the producer of that film also did music as well. Also knew a lot of different roles, and so he took a lot of the work that certain things I didn't have to do. But then when I got to A Question of Faith, he wasn't a part of that project, and I was pretty much I came in to do all the music. And it was like literally like, and I appreciate Angela's wife for getting me on the project, because she's a very interesting one. Like, she'll throw you in the fire because she believes in you. But she's gonna whip you while you're in the fire when you're not doing stuff right. She'll help train you on the spot. So I knew certain things to do. Thank God I had the sincere, so I kind of knew some of the stuff I needed to do. But overall, I was on Google a whole lot. I was reading a whole lot. I was calling people. I was researching stuff, and finding a different publishing company because we had the license to songs, and I had to figure out how to get to them. And thankfully, I knew the writers from the music world, so certain things I was able to kind of get to and talk to this person, talk to this guy at the label here, so that helped me. But it was a whole other ballgame. Like, I had to do any and everything to do with music. Did you get the contracts for the writers that you wrote with? Is this song, are you sure this song is public domain? We had a couple of songs that, were public domain, but are you sure? Was the paperwork on that? Did you register your cue sheet? That's a whole other ballgame, because now I'm responsible for the cue sheet. I didn't have to do that in other movies as a music supervisor, because the other producer did music. Now on this one, you're responsible for the cue sheet, how long the songs are. Are they good? I didn't get into all that, but it's it could be like the Question of Faith had a lot of different cues, like over 100 cues, and you got to write down who did it, what their percentage is, what kind of, is it background, is it visual, is it non-visual? Yeah, it's a beast of a job. I can't work a piece of the job, but I appreciate it.
More satisfying than anything else you've done, or it's just another kind of side of you?
And musically, it is. It's very much so a more satisfying job than I've ever done, because, again, to me, it helped me grow. Because it's one thing, I can do music in my sleep, honestly. I can produce in my sleep, I can write in my sleep. A lot of stuff that we did on the movie, I knew the scene, and I wrote specifically for the scene. Like, that stuff was simple, but everything else to me, it was kind of, now you're going into becoming a man, and you got to make sure that the paperwork are right, the verbiage is right, the amount's right, everything is cleared, and you got to turn in to the publishing, to the for the film company that's over the distribution or over the film, you got, that turned into a whole nother beast, a whole nother man, a whole nother aspect of manhood. So it definitely was, I would say, like, a major, one of the biggest and best things that I've ever could have done just because of how it grew me.
Okay. I want to ask you, what's next? Like, what's coming up?
Well, I know we're working on some things together. I've talked to Angela White, the producer of Question of Faith.
Okay.
We still stay in communication, and she's excited about a couple projects that she has coming up. And, of course, you know, because of what we did with the last project and how well we work together, I'm definitely going to be a part of that project and a couple other ones. She's also recommended me to a few other people who are looking for music for projects as well. So, you know, just continue to really, at this point, I'm really, with people to see, eventually I'm building a team of people, because that's even one of the things that was suggested for me the last movie from Cousin of Faith, because I did so, not knowing how much I'm going to have to do. I ended up having to do so much, thankfully learned so much, but, you know, everybody said, suggested, even Angela, you know, the next project, you need to have a team. Because that was a lot.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm building that team. And, you know, we want to go after more projects. And I want to give people a chance. I, you know, have a great group of people around me. I want to be able to offer opportunities for other people to be successful and do what they love to do. You know, just give them a chance. That, and then, you know, with the ministry, like, you know, of course, when people will see this eventually too within the next couple of years, the church and music is going to be married so well together. The same band is the same part of my team of work with the fam. So I'm definitely building a ministry that's going to be known for its music, for doing music and films, and for having a great musical experience during the ministry. So that I'm very excited about.
You mentioned the next few years, and that's a perfect segue. Where do you see yourself in 5 years?
In 5 years? Wow. I definitely see myself established more as a pastor in Los Angeles with a bigger influence. I see my relationships that I've already started to develop. I see those stronger. I see myself getting out more with the music, like I said, within our ministry. I see us being known as a church that has a very great musical presentation. I see us being, you know, my biggest thing is me seeing this ministry flourish and the music and the ministry being married together, and they know us for both. Like, on that 5 years from now, I definitely want to be on the map there. You know, a place where you can get a great word and be lifted, a place where there's no judgment, where people love God, people love you, and at the same time, like, they are doing something great within the music industry. People can come connect and can learn, can sing, can learn to play. Like, we have so many things that we're doing. So, again, you know, with the musical aspect, not just writing, but teaching, you know, consulting, all these different things we're working right now to pull together. So within 5 years, I definitely see us being that go-to place for all these different components. Excited. Just even seeing in my head, it's like, this is going to be great.
Wish all the blessings in the world upon you. Really a good conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time out. Go see his work in Question of the Faith. Sincere. Definitely, especially in Question of Faith, the amount of work that had to go in, because there's so many musical styles that happen in that movie. The last sequence with, I'm not going to give the movie away, but the last sequence is amazing. And did you choose those songs for that last scene, or that was kind of part of the director's, where he wanted to go with it?
Well, more so the producer with Angela. You know, we constantly talked about music because it was so important. So she had her suggestions, I had mine, and we just started to marry things together, how we wanted to do it. And she just trusted me to get it done. And, you know, the last song was a song we licensed, but prior to that was a song that I wrote. Last two songs were part of songs I was part of writing. All the originals, I either wrote them fully or co-wrote them with somebody else.
Okay.
And so, again, she just trusted me, and we brought them together, and yeah, it was, especially that last, like, to this day, like, I'm still having, even, which is the coolest thing to say, you have so many men of God that I've talked to, that, and the movie had them in tears.
Mm-hmm.
So, they really nailed that, the end of that film with the musical presentation, you know. And it's something, like I said, even now with the new film, that we're already talking about that, talking about music and how we want to articulate that even now. So it's definitely a big part of what we do.
If you haven't checked it out, even if you just got to watch the last sequence, I mean, that is a very powerful scene. And the music holds the whole scene together. And if you haven't seen it, you owe it to yourself to check that out. Brother, you have to come back. But next time you do anything, you just get a new car, just swing by. We'll talk about that for a little while. But I really appreciate it.
I would love to.
Welcome to the family. Have to say that. And as family, you can just, you know, knock on the door and walk in, so to speak.
Yes, sir. I appreciate that. Yes, sir.
Just want to thank Nelson Jackson III for stopping by the Brownstone and sharing with us his amazing journey. Please let us know what you think. Leave us a message on iTunes, SoundCloud, or on Instagram at BrownstoneMG. Check us out on the website too at viewfromthestoop.com. We do everything for you, our family members. There are big things coming in the future, and Brownstone wants you to be there for every moment of it. Once again, family, and as always, love.